Welcome to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback Neuropsychology Podcast featuring tech legend Jay Gunkelman. He is the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience NeuroGuide workshops in Madeira Beach, Florida, led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Earn up to 16 CEU hours. Hours now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now. Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Huarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu.
I think one of the things that's popped up recently was a magazine, a science magazine, basically suggesting that that Berger changed psychology, and that neuropsychology and psychology are all due to Berger. And I would like to kind of set history straight as to who that asshole was. It's been covered over and papered over by luminaries like Niedermeyer, saying that, you know, he wasn't really a Nazi and he was forced out of his position and, you know, he committed suicide because of the pressure and whatnot. But it's just bullshit. It's just covering over the history of our field with, you know, and, you know, there's a lot of things that grow up out of bullshit. But
mushrooms.
Not the kind that were the last of the world ones, but you know, discussing that a little bit, you know,
we're already discussing it.
Okay, but you know, the magazine basically, you know, Berger, he had a near death experience and thought of his sister at a great distance, and the telepathy, they had to have communicated, and that there must be something going through the ether, you know, between brains, and he was looking for that. Now, he was a Nazi, and he did experiments in Jena at the university on Jews that were prisoners, things like sticking thermometers in their brain. Well, that's not very friendly, you know. I'm not going to line up for somebody to, you know, oh, over here, I volunteer for a thermometer to be stuck in my, no, they usually stick it at the other end. You know, I don't know about the sticking it in your brain thing. And so, but, you know, he was doing experiments on Jews and not good ones. His experiment to record the EEG was non-invasive, and he did that on his son, but he was on sterilization boards where they decided, oh well, you're not the kind of person we want to see reproducing, so you get sterilized. If you're in the if a Jew was sent to the Neuropsychiatric Institute, they basically sterilized the women. And he had a diary that he kept. And in the diary, he's got entrances like, I went on vacation and those damn Jews were on the beach and it ruined my vacation. That's not very friendly or neighborly or, you know. But, you know, apparently, you know, having the founder of the phenomenon of EEG was enough that people wanted to kind of cover it over. I mean, it's an ugly history. There's no way around it. But you don't make history, you know, better by making it false. And there were a lot of people discovering electrical properties in animals' brains. If he hadn't published in the late 20s, it would have been, you know, done by somebody else. As soon as his paper was out, Adrian and Matthews in 1930 in England, Adrian had alpha, Matthews had a low voltage fast EEG that they called an EEG with no apparent rhythmicity. They didn't call it low voltage fast. At the same time, Lennox's lab at Harvard and Fred and Erna Gibbs, well, Erna wasn't a Gibbs at the moment, but they discovered that you could see epilepsy in the EEG. At the same point in time at the Mayo Clinic, you've got Charlie Yeager, not the pilot. That's how he always introduced an MD, PhD. Charlie Yeager, not the pilot. But they started their own lab. They made their own amps. Their amps were funky, and high moisture would ruin them, or a really big muscle contraction would ruin the amp. They had a crystal, a salt crystal, with a pen glued on the top of the crystal. And crystals are piezoelectric, and if you pass current through them, the crystal twists. So you got deflections from the EEG. And it's okay.
Did you say that?
It looks like you're in a better place than I am. I'm just sitting here at home on my chair. So
I'm in a backyard somewhere in Naples, Florida, Jay. And,
well, it looked like the attire and the background, you know. But Yeager and his lab in the early 30s, they actually had no budget. I mean, EEG wasn't a thing. They were trying to build their lab at the Mayo Clinic, and they started to paint their lab with whitewash. And the union painters in the hospital complained, you're using a paintbrush, which means you're violating our union contract. You can't use a paintbrush and paint your lab. But they were friendly union people. They were just trying to assert their union rights. And they said, use a broom. So they dipped the broom in, they painted their room with a broom, and got it all whitewashed and, you know, ready for lab work. But their amplifier was built on Epsom salt crystals. And the crystal would twist with the electrical current speed past the polarity of the current, which you basically end up with an oscillating current. And that twisted the crystal and printed out the EEG. Well, you know, other people used a mirror and a film going by, and the mirror deflected the light beam up and down, and that's how they got it. But the early days would have been the early days with or without Burgers being the one. It was happening. It was a zeitgeist. A zeitgeist is an idea whose time has come. And a zeitgeist happens. You know, the same thing discovered in four spots across the globe at about the same time. And everybody wants to claim being the founder of it. Well, you know, it's a zeitgeist. It doesn't matter who sticks their damn label of their name as the founder. It was something that was happening and would have happened with or without one or the other of the people who were finding them. So the fact that Berger was a Nazi shouldn't be papered over. It should be looked at. Now, let's say we packed our bags and jumped from California to Florida and we went over to Jena at the university. Well, at the university, there's a founder of the field of EEG who was there. Wouldn't there be a shrine? Wouldn't there be a laboratory that was kind of set aside as a memorial to the great man, you know, who founded this great field? You can't find shit for what went on in Jena. Germany treats Nazis appropriately. They erased them to the best of their ability. The fact that he still had diaries and stuff that could be found and read and translated, and there were some manuscripts. R. Douglas Fields, who wrote The Electric Brain, that has an honest and in-depth review of the early days of everything from people stimulating frog legs to make them twitch, you know, with electricity, and making cadavers move with you know, electricity, reanimating with electricity, all of the early experiments with electrical stuff with humans and animals is detailed. The founding of all of this is, and building up to the founding of EEG and applying that. Now, I think reading through his account ends up cutting through the attempt to cover over really quite accurately. He did a historian's level, go to Jena, spend weeks and weeks and weeks there with a translator going through papers and documents and journals and diaries, contemporaneous notes that were taken at sterilization boards, the fact that Berger appointed his replacement, who was a well-known Nazi, and he still sat on sterilization boards after he retired from the university. This wasn't somebody who was forced out for not being a Nazi. This was somebody who was had severe depression. When he stepped down from heading his department at the university, it isn't that he just went and killed himself. He was still ran around being the Nazi that he was. So,
Jay, when you bring up Hans Berger, Carl Ludwig always pops up with him. Why is that?
There were a lot of contemporaneous folks. Berger wasn't the only early character. And again, who was connected to who and where information was transferred back and forth and so forth. It was really quite dynamic. Berger was not the only early pioneer in EEG that committed suicide either. Kaufman, who was really quite famous, did himself in due to pressure. You know, he was basically not a Nazi, and he was pressured out of his position at the university. There's an interesting early history. I have to say that the book The Electric Brain doesn't stop by just, you know, dredging up material from the past and stopping. They actually go through the development of EEG into a clinical tool. The Gibbs and Gibbs work with epilepsy. The use of EEG for epilepsy and encephalopathies, And he went into neurofeedback. He actually had his EEG recorded out on the East Coast. They sent the EEG to me. I analyzed the EEG and reviewed it with him. He had a low voltage fast EEG. We discussed, this common in alcoholism. He says, "Oh, my wife has always told me I should drink more." Because it gives somebody with a low voltage fast EEG that calms them down to the point where they have alpha. And that kind of thing ends up being useful findings. Now, he actually sat for neurofeedback sessions. Jessica Ure in their office ran the sessions. His book actually has an interesting segment of it where he's doing just free association, whatever is on your mind, chatting as the stream of consciousness for quite a few pages of what was going on in his head during the session. And, a low voltage fast EEG is full of blah 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 blah, so it's going all over the damn place, and he's not getting, better scores and the little periods that the epoch of training time, and then there's a little sound.
What years are we talking about here, Jerry? What years?
This is only a few years ago. The book is a very recent book. Towards the end, they were ready to finish, but he said, "Well, give me one more try." And in that epoch, he starts to think and, scuba diving and floating down and relax. And the session went in a flash, he actually got relaxed and, got a good score for that session. He goes through from neurofeedback. He talks about brain computer interface, which has got some very interesting things going on. Obviously, Elon Musk's group, amongst others. And I have to say, Elon Musk's group really has been underwhelming in their demonstrations for brain computer interface. They haven't done anything more than Verbaumer had done 25 years, 30 years before that. So, kind of underwhelming. A chimp, a monkey that can play Pong. Pong was a game that Verbaumer used to train people to control their slow cortical potentials and train them how to not have epilepsy. Your slow cortical potential can go electronegative, your brain is on, or electropositive, your brain is more off. And they taught you to move the slow cortical potential up and down on screen as a paddle or a window. And they had it's a Pong, the funky graphics, they had a little rocket ship, the square with a point on one end, kind of that would fly from somewhere on the right axis across the page at some angle, and you could move the paddle up or down to fly it through the window. So you could adjust the speed across the screen and the size of the window to make it a more difficult task. But basically, somebody with epilepsy would take about 40 hours to learn how to operate that game well, so that a small window with a fairly rapid transit, and they could catch it, like the monkey playing Pong. In an epileptic, it took about 40 hours. For a normal person, about 4 hours. And that's not an uncommon difference. Jim Hart found a normal university student could learn alpha control in about 3.5 hours of training. Total training time, the fifth order learning curve, which was his PhD dissertation in 74. So, that you can learn control. We took Jim Hart's learning curve and applied it to our clinical patients who were being taught alpha. In 1972, when I started the lab, we were part of the alcoholism drug division at the state hospital. My patients that I had access to were all anybody in the alcoholism drug division or somewhere else in the hospital that somebody asked me to take a look at somebody. And the alcoholics were interesting because they had low voltage fast EEGs, very, very, very common pattern. Not everybody who drinks to excess, but people in the state hospital were there for a reason. The alcoholism drug division was populated by people who had a significant drinking problem. So you had a high probability of finding low voltage fast EEGs. When we found them, now think about it. In 1972, what could you be doing for neurofeedback? Well, SMR or alpha? I mean, Sturman or Kamiya? That was your choices, you know? So, and we looked at this low voltage fast stuff from the alcoholic and said, well, alpha. They don't have any alpha. Let's train alpha. Stupid kid, you know? We weren't thinking in fancy systems theories or anything like that. We were just thinking, no alpha, let's train it.
Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide workshops in Madeira Beach, Florida. They're led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Earn up to 16 CEU hours. Sign up now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Huarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu.
But we found about 14 hours, not 3.5 hours like a normal university person who's got some alpha in the first place, learning how to control it and make a lot more of it. Jim Hart was actually a student volunteer in an experiment at Kamiya's lab. And they hooked him up, and everybody at the lab went to lunch. And they forgot he was there. And a long lunch later, you know, university, some people go out for lunch, and they take a long lunch. So three
and
a half
hooked
hours.
Up this whole time. He's hooked up
he was,
this whole time.
He was hooked up the whole time, 3.5 hours. And his data, the learning curve of his data basically became the basis of his PhD dissertation. So, and it wasn't only his data that matched that learning curve. Other people with training also got the same basic learning curve. But, you know, we talked alpha training to alcoholics, and it took about 14 hours for most of the alcoholics to learn it. But those alcoholics didn't come back. Now, a state hospital's 12-step alcoholism program is not as good as the best ones you can find. I mean, you can go to some pretty fancy recovery places and, you know, be treated like a king in Malibu somewhere, you know, but this is a state hospital. And it more resembled One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest than anything like a Malibu treatment center. It wasn't that the people that got sent out didn't come back. They had about a 90% recidivism. Sometimes they came back really quickly. I remember a few that came back the same day they were dismissed. Drunk as a skunk, waving bottles of alcohol around in the air and yelling at the buildings. And we had to, you know, put them into the lockup for a while to detox them. But, the people we trained alpha, those guys didn't come back. And in 1974, we saw this being for 2 years so successful, we wrote a grant to NIH for alcoholism being trained alpha. Now they didn't fund it. That you know they quit funding everything in neurofeedback in the early 70s because of very poorly done research by Pashkowitz and Orne. They trained alpha up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down, never giving somebody a long enough learning curve to acquire, like observed by Jim Hart and Kamiya. So this on-off training, kind of like telling somebody you're going to take off in this jet, but you got to stop on the runway every hundred couple hundred feet. You know, you're never going to reach the critical speed to get lift off, and so they trained, showed no learning curve, and then concluded that alpha training didn't do anything. Well, the way they did it, it didn't do anything. But their research was used as a dismissal of the entire field, and the government just quit funding everything in neurofeedback. So when we applied in 74, there was no funding. Now, 1988, 89, Peniston and Kokolsky talked about alpha theta training out of manager Elmer and Elise Green's lab. And that pop became popularized somewhat from that point forward. But it, you know, the it, it's a zeitgeist. I mean, gee, no alpha in an alcoholic. Let's train alpha or alpha and theta. You know, the Elmer and Elise Green were into meditative state stuff a little bit more, and they did some theta work as well. We found perfectly good efficacy with just the alpha portion of the training. But you know, the field moved on and matured, and we've got a field now. We don't rest on the foundation of Nazism. We rest on the foundation of science, and the science was being done worldwide. The fact that there was one character that was a flawed character, that
Yeah,
was
Jay, I have a
early
question
on.
about that. We're talking third 20s, 30s, somewhere around there. The Nazis got going in early 30s, something like that. What did they take from the learnings, whether it was the Nazis or Australians, the American, whoever? What would so they picked up? They know they could pick up electricity. They could measure it. What did they do with it first? What was the first application?
In fact, Berger's end of it didn't come up with an application. He was still trying to come up with some way to do telepathy or communication at a distance, and that really hasn't panned out very much for a direct application. I mean, there are Monroe Institute and CIA folks that played around with remote viewing and things such as that, but that's not been a major application. The major applications occurred out of Adrian and Matthews and Harvard from Lennox's lab and the Gibbs finding epilepsy, and obviously epilepsy and encephalopathy became the limits for clinical EEG. After the 1950s, there really wasn't clinical application for lots of other things. There wasn't depression or autism
Here, let's talk about the biggest application, brain dead. When did that
or. Brain
become?
death was something that was played around with fairly early on. A live brain has electrical potentials in it, and you can measure that as and somebody that dies basically. And the literature about that essentially looking for a quote flat line. Well, you don't really get a flat line. You have, if the heart is still beating, you get brain dead, no EEG, but you have little cardiac cardioballistic blips going by, slow pulse artifact from the blood vessels swelling up. And if the person is dead and their brain is actually starting to, you know, decompose chemically, there's large slow sways of chemical degradation that end up happening. But largely, if you catch it at the right point in time, it essentially is flat. I've recorded an EEG where the person they wanted to see what was going on with his brain. They had a do not resuscitate order on him. His heart stopped. We called the you know, Code Blue, but they came in and said, well, these are do not resuscitate. As I finished the recording, he went from having EEG to having no EEG and no EKG. And on the way to being flat, there are gigantic bursts, hundreds and hundreds of microvolts down to nothing, back to hundreds and hundreds of microvolts. It's called burst suppression. And it's an easily identifiable pattern. I mean, it hits you in the face. My goodness, I've never seen this before. You know, flat lines interspersed with big bursts. But that's, you know, that's an end state.
Is that the background alpha, the resting state? Is that what you look at first, or just nothing at all?
In fact, there's something called an alpha coma. Normally, you see alpha at the back of the head, but if somebody has essentially passed virtually completely, you can see frontal alpha or slightly slower as theta. And that the alpha coma, the alpha is non-responsive, and it's basically not projection to the back of the head through the lateral geniculate. This is basically brainstem through the diffuse projection system to the frontal lobe, and it's a resting state frontal pattern that's unresponsive. The person doesn't have response to stimuli. There's no cognitive presence at that point. It's a grave prognosis. You know, your prognosis is that you're going to be in the grave pretty soon. And it can last for a while, but it's not really a recoverable pattern.
So we can say that's the first, that should have been the first application for EEG is brain death. Is that correct?
Well, it was something that people investigated. It's not exactly an application because you wouldn't need it to end up knowing if the person was dead. The brain death is something that people needed to know before the heart stops. If the brain is dead, you can harvest pieces. And that's the biggest use of brain death, is saying this person is dead. The body still has some life left in it. Let's take the pieces that can be used.
When did all this start, Jay? When you were doing, early 70s, 60s, or even before?
60s and 70s, there were brain death determinations. And again, there's various standards. You have to have no barbiturates in you or any significant sedatives. You have to show that the brain isn't being suppressed from that. You can get a flat line from barbiturates, which is recoverable. You know, and you go flat. In fact, if you have a serious head injury and they put you in a barbiturate coma, if they do an EEG at that point, it'll be a flat EEG. Barbiturate coma. And it lets the brain recover without the demand for oxygen because there's no activity requiring oxygen. There are standards. The body temperature has to be sufficient. I can't remember exactly. I think it's like 82 degrees or something. But if you're way cold, you can have suppressed activity that may recover as well. So there's specific standards that the amplifier has to have more sensitive settings than just the usual settings of 7 to 10 microvolts a millimeter for the EEG devices, printing devices. On screen, most of them are now 50 microvolts in a centimeter, which is equivalent of 5 in a millimeter. So, but you have to be able to go down to sensitivities of 2 microvolts in a millimeter, so that you can actually see if there's some microvolt level oscillations of some sort that are very, very, very faint. That they've got to go flat, basically. And when the brain goes and the heart goes, you don't have much time to harvest anything. So they'll look carefully now at brain death in order to have, viable transplant organs that haven't already started to decompose. So.
Jay, I'm going to try and find that article. Do you remember the publication that it was in for Berger?
Oh, it was just yesterday,
Okay.
and I tossed out a couple comments. He was a Nazi. I mean, and that that there was a person in the field that said, that's not the story of history that I learned. And this is because Niedermeyer and people like that were trying to paper over the history. And he actually went online, pulled up a PubMed little history piece, and they laid it right out. Although there were some who said he was not a Nazi and he was pressured out of his job and committed suicide. Others, many others say, and they go on and talk about the reality of it. Trust but verify. Well, he trusted my comment more than what he had learned, and he went and verified whether what he had learned or what I had said was correct. And
Don't even no provie. Trust but verify.
the trust but verify is fully appropriate. I mean, especially if you learn something that's an outlier data point.
Yeah.
Geez, that's not what I learned. Well, it's time to dig down and find out if what you learned was right or if what you just heard was right. And, no matter who the expert is, and for goodness sakes, I'm an old EEG tech. You shouldn't necessarily consider me the expert on everything. And, it's double check. But I go back to some of the early days. Charlie Yeager, who started Mayo Clinic, supervised me in San Francisco. He started the Langley Porter and the state hospitals in California. He gave me his Ofner T-type amplifier, serial number one, when he retired in his 80s. He invited me to his 100th birthday. He retired and moved to Paradise, California, which since has burned to the ground. But it was long after he had passed. And, I'm a joker. I stop for just a second and say, I'll accept that invitation if you accept the invite to mine. So he laughed and I said, sure.
The NeuroNoodle podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience NeuroGuide workshops in Madeira Beach, Florida, led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Earn up to 16 CEU hours. Hours now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now. Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Huarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu.